Welcome to Online Gods, a podcast about digital cultures in India and beyond. This month, we're going to be talking about Rumour with Irfan Ahmed and about Love, Sex and Desire with Paramita Vora. I'm your host, Ian Cook. Rumour is information distilled so finely that it can filter through anything. It does not need doors and windows. Sometimes it does not need people. It can exist free and wild, running from ear to ear without ever touching lips. Or so wrote Terry Pratchett, and it seems especially apt when thinking through the way information travels in our digital times. And it's certainly especially apt for the two things we're going to be discussing in this month's podcast. Now, as is the case with every podcast, we explore a concept relating to media in the first segment before moving on to speak with a real live online god, a person or group who can use the internet in an innovative or influential way. And in this month's episode, we're going to explore first the power of rumours before moving on to look at how love, sex and desire are discussed online via the web portal Agents of Ishq. Now, we're doing this as part of a wider exploration into digital dignity, organised for a project out of LMU Munich. And the project's PI is Sahana Udupa, and she's taking over interviews for the first segment today. So let's pass over to Sahana.
An important element of the digital media's so-called dark side is the spread of rumours and unverified news and information, which has prompted some scholars to define the contemporary moment as a post-truth society. This has also brought back older theories of media like propaganda, which would be unthinkable in new media scholarship just a few years ago. We thought new media was not at all about propaganda, it was about people's voice. So in this episode's concept section, we are turning our focus on digital media and rumour. I'm in conversation with Dr. Irfan Ahmed, who is researching rumour and digital media based on his ongoing work on the Indian parliamentary elections in 2014. A warm welcome to you, Irfan.
Thank you, Sahana, for having me. It is a pleasure talking to you.
So later this evening, in fact, Irfan is giving a talk here at LMU Munich on new media and rumour. But before that, we thought we should get his views for our broader podcast audience. So here we are. In this paper on rumour and new media, you begin with a very huge argument. And I quote, "What was rumour to pre-modern society? Television and new media are largely to contemporary nation states." So you are now, you're questioning the rupture between pre-modern and modern times, of especially in terms of the communication forms such as rumour. And I would like to kind of unpack this argument a bit. How do you compare rumour in the pre-modern times with contemporary new media? How and why are nation states participating in rumour? And how do digital media architectures provide an enabling condition for rumour to proliferate, as opposed to, say, print news cultures? So why would you say rumour is not very different from what we saw in the pre-modern times?
Thank you for this great question. I think actually you asked a set of questions, so let me try to answer it one by one. The passage that you cited, it assumes a kind of rupture. In fact, entire social science is based on this idea of rupture, in the sense that Europe, or ipso facto the rest of the world at large, we made a transition from so-called tradition to modernity.
Right.
And this modernization theory is based on the idea that the transition that we have made to modernity is also something desirable. So in building this idea is that we have also met a progress from non-transparency to transparency, from non-accountability to accountability, from unfairness to fairness. Now, I have doubts about it because I don't believe in the rupture theory. Now, the question that I'm interested in this paper is that, does the transition from the so-called traditional society to modern society in what ways did it allow us to access the question of truth? Has modern media, with its written culture, its visual culture, as opposed to pre-modern society where we had oral culture, and therefore the possibility of rumor was pervasive.
Mm-hmm.
But in the printed world, in the visual world, we can identify the sources, and therefore the possibility of rumor is less. At least this is the general understanding. But I'm questioning this by asking that has the so-called transition from the oral culture to the screen culture or to the written culture really made us more more accessible to the question of truth, you know? So your final question about the nation states.
Yes.
The way to address this is also, I'm interested, the general understanding of rumor is that it is more from the subaltern, from the underdogs, but I'm interested also in the rumor of the powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So the peasants, and which was the prime concern of the subaltern scholars and historians, I think landlords also spread rumor. And one of the many examples would be that if a laborer stole 1 kilo of grain, the landlord would magnify it and rumor it to the rest of the villagers and the population that actually this guy has stolen 20 kilos of grain. Landlord would also spread rumor of his benevolence if the landlord helped a poor person by laying out certain condition and it was accidental, but they would present it as if this is their natural habit to help all the poor. So to create a benevolent image, and given the power which was at the disposal of the landlord, this rumor could circulate more. So I see not a rupture but a continuity between the rumor of the powerful in the pre-modern times and the rumor which is also part of the nation states. And the nation states would need these rumors, or there are more likelihood, precisely because I think the general understanding of the nation state, especially in India, especially when it comes to elections or what the nation state does, the predominant model is one of welfare,
right,
that the state gives you services. So this is one model of national politics, but to me it appears that there is a side and coexisting model which is not of welfare but of warfare.
Mm-hmm.
Enmity.
Violence and enmity, yeah.
But and liberal democracy, and it is not unique to India, liberal democracy in general, despite its claim that we stand for individual rights, okay, but there is a contradiction in liberal democracy that you stand for individual rights, but the enemy production is always collectivized. It is not an individual. It is a culture. It is a collectivity. Now that that contradiction, and most nation states, as you know, they have been built on violence, you know. So this warfare logic, sometimes it may not go well with the welfare, and rumors become a medium to do that warfare politics in the language of welfare.
Absolutely. And I think you make two very important points here. The first one, I quote from your paper, the premise of rumor as a plebeian oral form of resistance is unsustainable. So it's not just a weapon of the weak, but it can be an instrument in the hands of the elite as well. And you see that continuity between rumor as an instrument in the hands of the elite to today's nation states using rumor in a very systematic way. And that brings me also to my work on online abuse cultures in India. I've been trying to understand how online media provides a forum for abuse cultures to expand. And when I was studying this online abuse culture, I was intrigued because this is precisely how I started my conceptual discussion. How rumor and abuse or irreverent language can be an instrument in the hands of the poor and can be an instrument in the hands of the weak to subvert dominant structures. That's the usual thinking. But we increasingly notice in countries like India that abuse and rumor are indeed means of reproducing relations of domination. And here we see that religious nationalists are using abuse cultures in a very, very prominent manner to intimidate dissenting voices. And that brings us to the question of the actual empirical work that you've been doing, the Indian parliamentary elections of 2014, based on which you've come up with this argument about rumor being a part of the nation-state machinery. So could you tell us a little more about how you thought rumor became important for the electoral preparations and the dynamics that went behind the electoral success of the current government?
I mean, this is very important. What has struck me in your work about the Gali culture, I was deeply struck by this story of Roshni, the journalist. So the journalist that I know better would be like, for example, since this was abuse heaped on her from Hindu nationalist side. So an example would be somebody like, you know, Barkhadat, who has been given such kind of abusive terms as, like, you know, not being a proper journalist, or even sometimes being described as belonging to prostitute and things like that.
In fact, I sorry to interrupt, but there are a slew of terms. For instance, libtard is a liberal retard.
Yes.
Secular is not the secular press, but the secular press. And like prostitute is one such epithet.
Yeah.
And these are the kind of word games or epithets that are thrown at. And therefore, I just try to understand online abuse culture as part of the gaming and fun culture of online media. And that brings us to the question of rumor as well. Do you think that there is something distinct about digital media that can facilitate rumor and abuse in the way we are seeing today?
I agree with you that the current forms of media and its digital character has in many ways given more possibility. So, but at the same time, we should also make note of the fact that even in the time of print culture, so I did my fieldwork in Aligarh Muslim University in 1990-91, there was a riot, quote unquote, in Aligarh. Now, Hindi newspapers like Amar Ujala, they printed on their front page that dozens of Hindu students have been killed at Jawaharlal Nehru Medical College of Aligarh Muslim University. And this was sheer rumor. But while this rumor was planted in the print, it was also shared orally in the Hindu neighborhood. So what you see here is a simultaneity of the oral and the printed. Okay? So they go hand in hand. And in fact, you look at the history of riots in India, all the riots, somewhere or the other, they begin with some kind of rumor. So what has happened now with the onset of the digital media, you don't have to wait for the newspaper next day. Okay, with your own smartphone or iPad, you can do this. But here I want to make a strong qualification by saying that, of course, it has increased the possibility of rumor, but the power hierarchy which exists in the society, social media has not completely disrupted that power hierarchy. Because your own work about Azad Maidan thing, and there are a colleague of mine in Australia, Maya Ranganathan, she has written about social media. It says that the asymmetry in the society is not undone by the access to the social media. So one has to acknowledge both the dimension of this digital media.
Absolutely. So I think cultures of media circulation, however potent in fueling the hopes of participation, I think they gravitate back to the ground reality of difference. And especially the way religious difference is mapped out in countries like India. So that also brings us to another point you make, which is equally interesting, how propaganda and rumor are coming closer. One cannot distinguish rumor from propaganda in the digital times. So could you elaborate a little more on that, the relationship between propaganda and rumor in the digital times?
If theoretical proposition is that, oh, the government lie, but since we can identify the sources, and therefore we should not be using the term rumor for the government, but only propaganda, for me, it doesn't make much sense, because the knowing and unknowing is a matter of time. Like the moment it is happening, you don't know. And you come to know of it only after the event has surpassed its significance, right? But even the fact that government does it stealthily, so this argument that government can know the sources, you know, I think it is not very valid. We have to take into account how the government can also represent itself as non-government.
And with that note, let us just end this conversation. And thank you so much, Irfan, for being with us. And thank you for your very, very provocative and insightful thoughts.
Thank you, Sana. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
I don't know about you, but I thought it was a really interesting interview. We often forget that the powerful can also use rumors for their own ends, and there are political consequences to this. What the digital is doing to rumors, I think, is something that we're only just beginning to understand, and I hope it's something that we're going to be able to come back to and explore further on down the line. Something else that we, or at least I don't probably understand, is love, or sex, or desire. But luckily, our next guest can help us with all that. At least, I hope she can. She is, after all, the creative director of Agents of Ishq. Agents of Ishq is a multimedia project about sex, love, and desire. In their tagline, they claim to give sex a good name, and they publish text, videos, images, and audio about such topics. And I'm really happy to have the creative director, Paramita Voha, here online. Hi, Paramita.
Hello.
Paramita is a filmmaker and writer based in Mumbai, and I'll post some links to her work on the website. But today we're going to talk about Agents of Ishq. And if I may, before I ask you the questions, I want to start with a story that came to mind, an anecdote rather, when I was looking for your site. So I lived for a couple of years in a smaller South Indian city. And one evening, I had about an hour to spare in between my work. And rather than going home, I stopped my motorbike by a tourist site by the side of the river. And the sun was setting and I thought I'd just sit up on this little stone area and watch the sun come down. And as I walked up the steps, I disturbed two couples in the middle of a actually they weren't different, they were doing exactly the same the two couples, and embarrassed I walked away and I parked my bike around the corner, and then I would just sit there and the sun completely set, and then a bike pulled up alongside me, and the guy asked me for a light, and I replied in Canada, the local language, and the guy realized I had a bit of an accent, and then thought I was from Kerala, the neighboring state. Yeah. And then when we realized, I'm English, we had a bit of a laugh, and then we started to talk to each other, and it realized he disturbed the same two couples, and then maybe because of the fact we just disturbed these couples, or maybe because it was pitch black and we couldn't really see each other and we were strangers, he started to ask me about sex. He started to ask me lots of questions about sex. He was a similar age to me, around 30 years old at the time. And his questions, I suppose, surprised me a little bit because they were very basic about contraception, about pregnancy, about, you know, and he was a virgin, as it turned out. And he had lots and lots of questions he wanted to ask me for his friend who had sex and a condom had split or something like this. And anyway, but then when I was looking through your site, I realized if your website didn't exist, I would invent it to be a place where, you know, two 30-year-old men could talk in the dark about sex and without any worries, shall we say. And so that's why if your website didn't exist, that's why I'd invent it. But I was wondering, why did you start the site?
So, to an extent, yes, for the same reasons that I think there's a lot of people who don't have basic information that you'd imagine is easy to have. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't really, I mean, that's never a sufficient reason for an artist to do something, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I think I was coming from much more a kind of feminist space, which is that I felt there was a lot of discussion about sex online, but it fell into two categories. One was always talking about sexual violence in some form or the other. And the other was a kind of posturing coolness in which the language was completely from American popular media, so that people were using these terms like Vajayjay and Kuchi, and even the entire cultural landscape that they would refer to didn't seem Indian to me. And I just thought, there's a kind of strange inversion of shame, like an inside-out shame that is occurring, where once upon a time people hid it if they were sexually active, and now people have to hide it if they're not sexually active or not sexually informed. And to me, this seemed like the one way to break this is not only by giving information, but really creating an environment in which it is okay to not know something. Because I feel the barrier is not only accessing information, it is overcoming the hesitation inside you to say, hey, I don't know, and I'd like to know, right? So that's why Agents of Ishq was conceived. And also because I think that as long as you keep talking about sex only in terms of violence, then you perpetuate all the things that make sexual violence happen.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be an antidote to it. And the antidote is not, when there is violence around us, the antidote is not to speak more about violence and to make sex sound like a risk and a terrible, like, you know, one of those pulp novels about how it will make you come to a bad end, but rather to celebrate love and sex and romance and pleasure, and make it possible to make your own sexual journey through this space. So that's why Agents of Ishq was created, to have a space which where sex would have a good name, as we say, but where anyone could come in. That would be a completely inclusive online space.
Could you just give us a description of the site? What can people find if they visit Agents of Ishq?
So Agents of Ishq has got multimedia, as I said, videos, podcasts, text, infographics. And it's mostly arranged along three kinds of thematics. One is sexual information. The other is sexual experience. And the third is sexual culture and concepts. So, for example, in information, you will have stuff about STIs, contraceptive choice, what is intersex, resources like A Beginner's Guide to Kissing, everything you need to know about anal sex, that sort of thing. Like, so information on sex and sexual activity and sexual safety. In sexual experience, it's a huge number of user-generated narratives of their own sexual experiences, which could be emotional, which could be sexual, which could be cultural, whatever. But they are first-person narratives. In sexual culture, we have, like, say we have this video called The Consent Lavni. So there'll be a video on consent. There's a video on how to make a move without being a creep. There's videos which are just kind of discussing the concepts around sexual culture, like queerness and consent, which help people to think about these things a little bit in an entertaining kind of way. And I guess there are always, like, there's a bunch of, like, there's a section we call Mazedar Matter, like stuff which is just for fun. So, you know, there'll be like little memes over there. What do women really want? Or cards you can send your parents to tell them you did it, or, you know, that kind of fun stuff. So the way that it was conceived was to create an artistic environment that was not alienating, that would be very Desi, very Indian, which would be friendly, and which would be playful, and also help to create a language with which to talk about sex. Because I think that's really what's gone missing. When I say that all the language that was online was very Americanized, I feel that what is missing is that maybe earlier there was a language which was very courtly of romance and sex, or a language which is very folksy about sex. But there isn't really a contemporary language of sex which is Indian. And it was an effort to kind of start that as well.
Mm-hmm. Just on that.
So that is why it's called Agents of Ishq, right? Because Ishq is, yes, it's an Urdu word, but it combines the idea of sex and love. Also, we wanted to create a space in which love, sex, and desire were not in silos, but kind of exist in an intertwined way, so that you don't feel like something is only sex or only love, but rather there are, like, they're all wound up together in a universe of intimacy.
Mm-hmm. Just on the point of the name, maybe could you explain it for those who aren't familiar with the South Asian context?
So Agents of, so when we were trying to come up with a name, it was difficult, right? And one of the names we came up with was, I wanted to use the word Ishq, because it's a very common term used for love in a lot of Hindi film songs and in popular poetry, you know. So it immediately has a kind of fun. I won't say it's not serious. Like, it has a serious emotional meaning, but Ishq is not linked to marriage or the act of sex. Rather, it is the condition of being full of desire. And that desire could be romantic, it could be sexual, it could be anything, right? So the word ishq was very potent in that way. And of course, the in-joke was that if it were an acronym, it would be Indian Sex Headquarters. So we became agents of ishq. And we also liked that, we liked the agents of ishq because, you know, it took away from that very politically correct NGO-ish language of agency.
Mm-hmm.
And made agents into some kind of like spy or, you know, undercover agent. So it sort of created a sense of fun. And in fact, what has been so interesting is that we had, when we put out the website, we wrote, do you want to be an agent of ishq? Contact us if you want to be an agent of ishq. But we did that in a kind of playful way. It was just another way of writing, contact us. What ended up happening is really that became a sort of call for people. Because they became free to interpret ishq any which way they wanted, and also free to interpret what they thought made them an agent of ishq. So in fact, all the mail that began to come in, and a little bit about of how the site grew in a way, was very directly related to this term, agent of ishq, and that it allowed a free-floating interpretation for different people and allowed them to enter the site on their own terms.
And then just on words then, you said you wanted to develop a new language, like a Indian language to talk about sex. Have any sort of new words sprung out or new ways of talking about? I mean, do you have some sort of language developing on the side?
I think that, you know, we have to constantly find a kind of... So when I say language, there are two levels of it. One is just, you know, kind of... language world, I would say. So it's not specifically vocabulary as much as a way of talking that we wanted to evolve, which I think definitely has happened on the site. And what we find is, so some of it is that we do it ourselves, but some of it is because we have a huge number of submissions from people, from readers and users of the site. It also evolves from the way they talk about something. And I would say that it's a kind of mixture of different languages. So you find that Hindi, English, or sometimes with little touches of Tamil or Marathi or whatever language is native to the person who's sending us the piece. So you find this kind of a mixture. What I also really find interesting is that people freely use mixture of words, which are sometimes very romantic and tender and sometimes very directly sexual, right? So for example, people are quite relaxed about using words like fucking or pussy. You know, that kind of thing. They say masturbation without hesitation. But there will also be lots of beautiful, poetic, sweet words which are to do with love and feeling turned on. Like people will say horny. Now, these are not things we expected, right? That people would write in this combination. But I think what comes through is that people actually do write with a combination of emotion and carnality and switch between the two registers with a lot of comfort. And I feel that is actually the way that people relate to sex anyway in their own lives, right?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
That kind of language world that emerges.
Yeah, it reminds me of whatever partner you have, you always end up developing words or phrases for everything you do in the bedroom or wherever you do it. And then it reminds me of that you basically, through a relationship, words, new words and new phrases come out. It's a really nice idea. I was wondering,
I think like sometimes you get stuck, like, you know, what's the Hindi word for queer? There is no Hindi word for queer. So, for example, we use the word atranga, which means that color of, which is like no other color, right? So, I mean, obviously, we'd have to popularize this more because it's not automatically clear that it means queer. But, so these are some of the, when we are doing the translations, especially, we frequently come up against this kind of thing. Like, we'll have to create a word for something.
Super interesting. And I wonder if you have any idea, a few episodes ago, we interviewed Nisha Susan from The Lady's Finger, and she said that she felt a lot of their readership was metro-centered, you know, from the big cities. And they, rightly or wrongly, have a reputation for being more liberal in terms of being able to have discussions about sex or even, you know, have sex compared to smaller cities, which is still, or villages even, which is still where most Indians live. And I was wondering, do you feel that most of your submissions are coming from these, from the metros, or are you getting stuff from, you know, the rest of India?
So, you know, I mean, there is a question of internet penetration. So we would obviously not end up getting on its own a huge number of submissions from the hinterland, as they would call it, right? Like not from, definitely not from rural spaces. So our readership is, from what I understand, is not, is metro, not centric, But there's a core readership which is definitely in the metro cities.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have a lot of people from the B centers
coming
to the site. And we also have submissions from smaller places. So we would get stuff from, say, Ahmedabad or Lucknow or, you know, those kinds of cities, tier two cities. We know from the way that people write, because we do a lot of editing on our pieces. And from the mail that we get and from the submissions that we get, we know that English is not always the first language of the people who are writing for us.
For sure.
Or writing to us. So we know that there is a mixed audience. And I think one of the things, I mean, there are various reasons for this. One of them is that the site is bilingual. There is a whole, everything is in Hindi as well. So that already opens it up. I don't think that our Hindi readership is very huge, frankly, but it opens it up to the possibility that other people will discover and slowly begin entering the site. So that's one thing. And again, I feel like, you know, for example, when we talked about condom use, we created this character called Munna, the singing condom. Now, Munna is a name you call a child, or it's like a pet name. It's also a little bit condescending. But so because we also use this kind of language, it automatically signals that this is not meant only for elites.
Mm-hmm.
And we are also not in the business of being ironic and snarky. Like, there's a very strict line on Agents of Ishq. Like, every intern who comes in, everybody who works in the social media, we will never be snarky. There will be no unnecessary sarcasm or irony. On Agents of Ishq is highly sincere in its entire personality. It's tongue-in-cheek, and it's mischievous and naughty, but it's not ironic or hipster or snarky, right? So I think that also is what cuts past that kind of regular liberal kind of lot of people. And I do find that sometimes when, you know, English-speaking liberal people write for us, they have a tendency to fall into this kind of a phraseology of, let's not do this, okay? And I'm just like, why are you talking like Mother Superior, you know? Why are you telling other people what to do or not to do? So I think, like, that is the thing that allows our readership to be a bit wider. That said, I also think one can't rely on the online space to be the only source of everything. You know, there is a huge offline space that exists, which is not accessing or inhabiting the online space in quite the same way. And there are many, many people online who need to inhabit the offline space a little bit more, in my opinion. So we actually do workshops in rural spaces. We have done. Or we did a workshop in Dharavi, which is obviously not a rural space, but it is working poor. So in the city of Bombay, but they would not be using the internet in the way that you or I would be using it. So these workshops, when we go out and we do them, they generate a different kind of narrative. But let me say, in terms of sexual liberalness, I don't think that metro city inhabitants are more progressive. In fact, they may well be less so. Because the kind of, like, if you listen to our podcasts, which have been recorded, like, we did a collaboration with Khabar Leheria. So we also collaborate with the other organizations to do this. So Khabar Leheria is a women's news service in UP, Uttar Pradesh, and mostly working in a district called Bundelkhand. So we did a workshop in a really tiny town called Chitrakoot. And I was amazed at the stories that people recorded, right? So I think that there is an assumption again about what is Indian and what Indian sex life is, but nobody actually knows. You know?
Yes.
And India is definitely one of those, that cliche about India, that everything is true in India, is true. But I also think that for too long, people who live in urban spaces of a certain kind have defined what the rest of India is like, but they don't really know. And I think for us, through Agents of Ishq, there are new discoveries, and hopefully for other Indians too, of what kind of sexual lives people have in smaller places.
My friend who's from a small village, when she first heard about polyamory, said, oh, polyamory, that's just what happens in villages all the time anyway. It's just that, it's just that nobody goes, just that people don't tell everybody about it all the time. Yeah.
You know, we actually did a podcast in which a young man talked about how he went to the village. So he lived in a town, but he used to go to the village for his summer holidays, and how he was fooling around with a bunch of boys near the village well, and then they ended up having sex. And then the next time that he went to the village for holidays, he ended up having sex with a woman. And then he's like, well, I think I like women more than men, but I don't mind men. And, you know, this is not a guy that comes from some, and like, he was a Hindi-speaking man who, if you saw him, he just had a regular job in a small office or something like that. So when we were editing the podcast in the office, my colleague said to me, this guy is so lucky, you know, he talks about sex so freely. What must it be to have such an easygoing relationship with the idea of sex? And I think these are things that people don't know. They don't know that there are people like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a discovery, but it's a discovery that you sometimes have to go out and make. You can't believe in the internet as some kind of a, like, you know, magic pill that it's automatically egalitarian. Like, I've never believed that about technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's too dangerous to believe that the internet automatically generates a kind of accurate public sphere.
Definitely, definitely. And then so my final question maybe is a bit broader, but draws on exactly what you just said. Do you think that then the online space is maybe a good one for dignified discussion about sex, or do you, I mean, what's the potential and what are the pitfalls there as more and more discussion takes place online?
Well, you know, I don't know that the online per se offers anything. It's a kind of receptacle. Mm-hmm. And, or it's like maybe a kind of IKEA where you can go and maybe assemble something, but really you have to make some kind of a gesture. To me, because I'm an artist, that is what I can speak from. And I do believe that somehow the internet, the entire space has become very modular. And it encourages a kind of polarity in the way it is structured. And I don't think that polarities are dignified, because even to convert yourself into binary is to do a terrible violence to yourself at any level. I think that there have to be other kind of formal interventions. I think that Agents of Ishq has many interventions it makes. But his primary intervention is a formal intervention. It is saying that here is the internet. These are all the tools available on the internet that I can reach anybody, maybe, potentially. That is, it's not constrained except by Facebook's algorithms, who it reaches. And that is really, it's really a tough one, the Facebook algorithm. But I have this ability to self-publish. I can put up multimedia. These are all the things that the internet enables me to do. Now, the next step is really to conceive of a space which will allow for what you're calling dignified discussion. How do I dignify the person who's coming in here? How does this space honor their emotions? How does it reassure them and give them confidence and faith that they will be respected? That is something that we have to do by generating a space. To me, I think that when people write to us at Agents of Ish using their real names, writing to the Agents of Ish general email ID saying, I want to write a piece about something extremely intimate, sometimes even shocking,
mm-hmm.
And then say, I would like to publish it anonymously. I find it a beautiful kind of show of faith, because they are trusting us not to reveal their identities. You may say it's foolish, and maybe it is foolish, I don't know. But I do believe that because the space has been crafted with love, it's a very lovingly created space, and it genuinely wants to, you know, Agents of Ishq is a space that is being co-created, but in a guided kind of way. It's not being left to anybody to do anything. It's a home that we have created. We do welcome people into it, but then we refashion it all the time depending on how people are responding to it. So I think there is a way in which we too feel able to maintain their trust. And there is something that we can communicate through our language and aesthetics, which lets people know that they will be okay here. Right? And so I think that's an effort you make as an individual or as a group of individuals. That is the political intervention you do. The internet itself makes it possible to make those gestures, but the gesture has to be yours.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for that answer and on all your visits. It's been really great to have you on Online Gods today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Wow, that was really wonderful, I think. And I want to follow up on that last point about creating the sort of environment or community online that allows for dignified discussion. It seems to me to be a really important one, not only because I'm drawn to it, I think, because it chimes nicely with anarchistic notions of spending time to create common ground, but also because it serves as a more pleasant counterpoint to the horribleness of Twitter and Facebook. You know, scale and the lack of cultivation of community probably really play a big part in making those spaces so mean. In any case, it was a really fascinating interview with Paramitra. That's it for us this week. Thanks so much for everyone for subscribing. Those who've noticed, we now also have an email subscribe as well as RSS feeds. Please follow us on Twitter, 4 with a number, Digital Dignity, and Facebook in the same way, or check out the project website. That's 4FOR, digitaldignity.com. You can send me an email at onlinegodspodcast@gmail.com, or of course, leave comments on social media and we'll get back to you. Thanks again for listening. Ta-ra! Thank you so much for listening to the Online Gods podcast. Online Gods is part of the project Online ARPOL, funded by the European Research Council, starting grant agreement number 714285. The project's PI is Sahan Udapa, who's Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology, Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, Germany. This podcast, like all the podcasts, is brought to you in collaboration with the HOW Network for Ethnographic Theory, my personal favourite network for ethnographic theory. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Goodbye.